except I vow to chase the truth of the Tathagata's words.
Good morning and welcome.
I know all of you. And I met Daniel just now. So I wanted to talk this morning about a case from the Book of Serenity that Mary's familiar with. I don't know if you are, all are. This is case 45. Just an intro to the... Are you familiar with the Koan collections at all?
Mm-hmm.
And you? Okay, so are you...
They're very familiar with the Xinjin Ming, which is sort of echoed there.
Okay. All right, so Hongzhi, as you know, selected all the koans in the Book of Serenity in about in the 1100s. And I would really like to know him. he was a great poet and a very subtle kind of Soto model for us. And his verses are really good, case after case. And his selection is good. And this particular selection stands out. I've been going through the whole Book of Serenity, and we're, you know, half of it so far. And this one, this particular case stands out as being different from the rest in a way that I really like. And I've been studying it with a couple of other people, and they felt the same way about it. And what's different about this case is that there's no conversation going on between a teacher and a student, or between two students or two teachers. It's actually four sentences that are extracted from a sutra from probably the 4th or 5th century in China. Maybe a little later, maybe 7th, 6th century. Anyway, it's a Zen sutra, it's a Mahayana sutra, called the Sutra of Complete Enlightenment. And it's, I have a copy of it. It's very, I guess, dense and big, and talks about all the different aspects of enlightenment and what you should do right, what you could do, what you might be doing wrong. And it's very intricate and kind of thorough and long, actually, as a sutra. And Hongzhi takes this kind of very big, complex, but also good sutra and extracts four sentences from it and keeps it really simple. And while the sutra is about enlightenment, basically, and all the steps to practicing to get to enlightenment or to recognize enlightenment or realize enlightenment, Hongzhi isn't interested so much in enlightenment. That word doesn't come up. He's just interested in these four suggestions about how to practice. So he takes something which is rather complex and keeps it really simple, which is his way, but he doesn't dumb it down at all. So in a way, it's a kind of take something that's Zen already and makes it more Zen, makes it more simple from something that was already definitely not a traditional sutra in the way that it was put together. So here are the four sentences from that he extracts. And I, looking up these sentences in the sutra, I thought, well, they would have a kind of a particular place of importance because he picked these four. They're not. There's no importance given to these four sentences more than any other sentences in the sutra. They just show up, and they're part of that particular chapter of the sutra. But nobody makes a big deal about them. And even Master Shengyan, who's a modern, he died about, I think, 10 years ago, modern Chinese teacher who I visited him in his group in Queens, New York, several times to go to 7-day sesshins. And he has a whole book on this that his group did. And they spent several years actually translating it into a translation that they felt comfortable with. And even he, in his commentary within the translation, doesn't point these four sentences out or doesn't fuss about them at all. So that was kind of interesting. Here are the four sentences. At all times, do not produce delusive thoughts. Number two is, yet, when there are all kinds of delusive thoughts, you do not extinguish them. Number three is, in the midst of deluded concepts, you should not add discriminations. And four is, amidst non-discrimination, you should not distinguish true reality.
Could you read the last one?
I'll read you all four again. Okay. At all times, do not produce delusive thoughts. Second one is, yet, when there are all kinds of delusive thoughts, you do not extinguish them. Third one is, in the midst of deluded concepts, you should not add discriminations. And the fourth one is amidst non-discrimination, or basically no thought. Amidst non-discrimination, you should not distinguish true reality. So I'd just like to go through these, my way of understanding these four, and you can comment on them, and you might have a different take on them. Why I like these is that they're actually how to do Zazen. And they're also actually how to be active as well, how to live our active life as well. So but it's very unusual for Zen, the Fukan Zazengi is an introduction to how to do Zazen. There's not much talk about the method of doing Zazen, what happens within Zazen, in the literature that I'm familiar with, at least. And so these are all very applicable to sitting practice, which is very unusual for a sutra, for a koan to do that. They might make one point, but these are all like four guides. So the first one is setting such a high bar that you might just want to give up, At all times, do not produce delusive thoughts. It's almost like they're joking, right? At all times, do not produce delusive thoughts. So I thought about that, and I think we all know what delusive thoughts are in Zen, but just to say, if you want to know where to start, you could start with the three marks of existence or three seals of existence, the fact that we suffer because we're constantly wanting something to be different than it actually is. Impermanence, that we don't want to die, for one thing. We want to keep on living. We can't really accept the fact that we came into existence and we'll go out of existence. We can't fully emotionally, intellectually, no problem. But emotionally, we prefer to keep on going, most of us, unless we're really sick and ailing and suffering physically. And then no self, which is the hardest of all, because our egos are set up to kind of guide us and protect us, and to let go of that sense of me, that's kind of solid and needed to be protected on an emotional basis, an intellectual basis, is what we all do, but Buddhism is about looking into what that really is all about, and particularly Zen practice. And the other thing is, in all the koans are about duality, non-duality and duality, and how they, the playing the dance of duality and non-duality. which is what Zen, this is a specialty of Zen practice. And the three marks of existence, or the three seals, are all dualistic. I mean, our suffering is that we don't like this, but we like that. No self is, I want to protect me. You're a threat to me because you said something hurtful to me. I need to protect myself against you. I think it's okay to protect yourself against wolves and bears and lions, but we don't need to protect ourselves as emotionally as we think we do. So there's a separation between me and you, because if we got along, fine, but if we don't get along, then I get a little antsy. I need to protect myself. And then impermanence, we like things that we like to be permanent. We like things that we don't like to be impermanent. And if they get crossed, the wires crossed, we don't like it, we feel bad. And Mary mentioned to me that you're in the midst of Black History Month. And so I realized, how our practice is very personal kind of practice. I mean, we practice as a Sangha, but we're all working on our personal stuff. Whereas social kinds of delusions, they're societal delusions as well as personal delusions. So how do we work on a societal delusion? And I think that's some concern to people that practice meditation a lot, spend a lot of time in the Zendo. Well, are we really being responsible, taking care of the world outside of our little Zen practice, while the world is basically seems to constantly be in flames? And what I notice in the world is just basically tribalism developing, just becoming stronger and stronger. Racial tribalism, religious tribalism, ethnic tribalism, national tribalism. Everybody's separating. This is our group, and your group is over there, and our group is over here. Your group may be a threat to us, so be careful. And this is all over the world. So what are we... In terms of social practice, what do we do? So I want to just read to you something that Sojin, he's supposed to have said, but I think they did some editing because this is a little bit more perfect and profound than the way he usually talks. But this is something that I'm working on a book, collaborating with some other people about trying to gather some of his talks together into a book format. So that's where this comes from. He says, I'll keep kind of edit it down just for time purposes. Suzuki Roshi once described our practice as lighting up our own corner of the world. In the Diamond Sutra, it says, although there are no sentient beings to be saved, we must save them all. What does it mean to light up our own corner of the world as well as saving all beings? As self-creating humans, we have the capacity to influence our own house and our own environment and surroundings. Each one of us has a sphere of influence. When we do zazen in the morning, prajna arises in the world, radiant light arises and manifests in the world, and our activity proceeds from zazen and is sustained as compassionate action. The influence of our practice can have a positive, far-reaching effect on the world. We can practice for the benefit of all beings without being attached to impossible results. This is shikantaza, just doing. It is genjo koan, the koan of our daily life. Moment by moment, it proceeds from zazen. When we can forget ourselves and support those around us, the way of harmony appears unhindered. Strong confidence comes little by little through small successes. And what I would add to that in terms of social, cutting through social delusion, is that each of us, there's a Bob Dylan song, and it goes, his words are, each of us has our own special gift, and you know this was meant to be true. So don't underestimate me, and I won't underestimate you. So I think each of us have qualities that are our qualities, and we should use our qualities in the way that's appropriate if we want to help others and help the world, and not to compare ourselves to somebody else who's a great orator or really, really smart or whatever. Just to be who we are, and with what we've got, we do what we can do, and realize that there's limitations to that, but find out what our strength is and then use that, and what our interest is and use that. The second sentence that Hongzhi picked, yet when there are all kinds of delusive thoughts, you do not extinguish them. So what he's saying there is, don't try to manipulate. We should not try to manipulate our minds to be some image that we have of what a good Buddhist person is, or some idea of perfection. We shouldn't try to steer our minds. And that's contrary to some other ways of looking at Buddhist ways of looking at it. But the emphasis here, and with Hongzhi, is actually the one translation of the Book of Serenity is the Book of Not Forcing Things in literal Chinese. So Hongzhi is all about not forcing, you know, but actually going with the way things are rather than trying to make things the way we think they should be, which we all do that. But he's saying, back off, even if you know that you're deluded, rather than try to get rid of your delusion. He doesn't say what to do. He just says, don't try to get rid of it. I would say what to do is just be aware of it and have the confidence and the trust that our awareness will teach us something, but not be in some hurry to consolidate that teaching into an effect and, okay, now I've cleaned up my act, you know. So just to be aware of our act rather than trying to clean up our act is more of Hongzhi's way and also Zen's way. And there's other formats of Buddhism where that's not the case, where you make yourself into a good person, and we shouldn't denigrate that either. That's just a different approach. So that's more of a Theravadan type approach. So in the midst of deluded concepts, the third one, in the midst of deluded concepts, you should not add discriminations. So this one is kind of a little bit more tricky. When we realize that we're how crazy we are, when we realize that, then we want to, there's a tendency, especially among people who are more introverted, I think, pensive, intellectual, to try to figure this out. How can I straighten this out? You know, if this isn't the right way, if this doesn't feel right, but what would be the right way? Now, if I did this, you know, and then we're sort of going through these machinations about how we can straighten ourselves out by our thought process. And one of my favorite Tang Dynasty Chinese teachers, no, actually Song Dynasty in the 1100s, Fo Yan, he has, there's a book, The Clear, he did of his talks. It's quite nice, quite good, quite good little book. Fo Yan has a chapter, and in the chapter, he basically talks about something like this, and his analogy is, he says, it's like riding a donkey to find a donkey. In other words, you're riding on your thought process. You're riding on your mind. You're riding your mind, trying to find out what your real mind is. But your mind is the one that's looking for your real mind. So it's like riding a donkey to find a donkey. So that's a really good analogy. And yet, that's how we do problem solving. So we're just using our basic, usual methods of problem solving here. I mean, it makes sense. Should give ourselves some credit, but this Zen way of problem solving is not so much a mental way of trying to figure things out and line things up and then arrange things, which is what we usually do without thinking about it like that. And again, just having trust, my feeling is just having trust in our awareness to present us with being aware and not have a preset idea where that's going to lead or what that's all about. It could be what Mary was referring to on the Shin Chen Ming, trust in mind. Trust in mind. You know, trust our own. Trust in mind. And the mind is not so much the thinking mind, although it doesn't exclude the thinking mind. But trust in mind means trust. And Shin Chen Ming, I'm not sure how they're referring to mind, because the mind can be really big. But I would say just trust in our our fundamental intelligence, our fundamental awareness. And part of that, I would say, is just with awareness of what's going on in our minds, in our busy little minds, is feeling the tone of that. That awareness is of the tone, and we learn something from the tone of our mind. If our mind is chattering along, we learn something from that. If we're more quiet one time, we learn something from that. But it's not an intellectual kind of learning, it's an experiential kind of learning. And then the fourth one is, amidst non-discrimination, you should not distinguish true reality. So non-discrimination is, well, if we can actually be in a place where we're not discriminating, where we're not being dualistic, where we can see where the oneness of things is just evident without having to think, well, okay, so if we're in this state of mind where we're not dividing everything up, at that point, when we realize, oh, this is great, you know, I'm not dividing things up, don't say, oh, this is it, you know, this is it. Then we're coming right back to the same thing of, oh, here's reality right out here, and this must be reality. There's a Robin Williams old comedy album, and the name of it is Reality, What a Concept. And a little bit more raunchy example of that is Robert Crumb's we're all of an age that we probably have some, you may be a little bit young, but all of an age that we know Robert Crumb and...
R. Crumb, and
Mr. Natural, who's like the Zen sage, and Flaky Fuent, who's kind of the nerd who doesn't get it. So Flaky says, Mr. Natural, what's it all about? Mr. Natural says, it ain't shit. So it's not, I mean, it's humorous, but actually there's something to that, you know. In other words, Flicky is looking for, what's it all about? Tell me. I want to look at what it's all about. And even though intellectually we may realize the delusion of that, emotionally, I'd say probably people don't practice seriously unless they have some of that feeling of, I want to know what it's all about. And And it's not necessary to have that feeling. That could be called a way-seeking mind, actually. It's just what we make, we find our way. And there's a good story, Blanche Hartman, I think you all know her. Last time I saw her before she died, she was here. And she had a bad limp. And she was clearly suffering physically. And we did fast Kenyan around, I think we even into the other side. And she was determined to do it. She was just limping and trying to keep moving and keep up with everybody. So anyway, I just want to acknowledge that she, it was painful to watch her, but also it was inspiring of her determination.
It's been the 15th anniversary.
Yeah, something like that.
We did the circumambulation.
Yeah, and she was determined to be, and I think she gave a talk or something. Whatever it was, she was in it. One of her favorite stories is that when she was studying with Suzuki Roshi, she went through a period of Zazen. This is in the early days of San Francisco Zen Center, more or less. And she went through a period of Zazen where she had almost no thinking going on, which really was exciting to her, which is what they're talking about in this fourth sentence. So she went into Suzuki Roshi and she said, I was able to sit all period and hardly a thought came up. And Suzuki Roshi said, you don't sit Zazen, Zazen sits Zazen. So he was disarming her thrill about me. I've realized this, and trying to move her away from that.
I think he smacked his stick, not on her, but on the
other. Oh, yeah?
You think you sit Zazen, Zazen sits. Oh,
that got the point across.
It sure. She seemed to remember it.
Yeah. Okay, so that's it. I just wanted to stop there. And each of those four is something we experience in Zazen, I would say, and also in our active life. One thing, going back to number one, the first and the most difficult, don't take up deluded thinking. I thought, well, how can I make that practical? I mean, that sounds impossible, but what if I just took that literally? Let's just take it. I don't know if they're meaning it literally, but I'm going to take it literally. Okay, I'm not going to bring up any delusive thoughts. How would I do that? And I realized that actually, that we can, there are patterns that we have that we recognize, and habit patterns, of mental habit patterns, and that we can recognize when they keep emerging. And there's a lot of ones that we can't recognize. We're still riding on our donkey, looking for the donkey. But there are patterns that we are familiar with in ourselves. Even though we aware of them, they still come up emotionally. So when those come up emotionally, we can catch that and not extinguish it, but just let go of the energy of that. And I think we may do that whether we think about it or not. It's a natural outgrowth of sitting practice, of the quality of letting go rather than getting rid of. There's a difference there. And letting go is just let go of the energy of it. Because all those require energy. I have a certain kind of self-consciousness that I'm aware of. And when I feel it being particularly strong, I just let go of it. Don't worry about it. It may still be there, but not to worry about it, not to be concerned about it. But at the same time, to not take it so seriously. So I'd say maybe not taking one's own habits so one can recognize, not taking them so seriously as they start up in all kinds of occasions. So each one of these things, although they seem kind of, in a way, a little bit abstract, we can actually make them literal. So I'll stop. Do you have any comments, questions, disagreements? That.
Thank you. That was really interesting. And it made me think of two quotes. One is Suzuki Roshi, I think in Zen Mind, Beginner Mind, when he says, seeing things as it is. Mm-hmm. And just kind of accepting this as the way it is. And sort of similar to that by John Madden, the football coach, said when the team was losing in the locker room, he said, "Don't worry that the mule's blind, keep loading the wagon." And I quote that one all the time. When, don't analyze and think so much, just do. So I kind of got some of those sentiments from that.
I used to watch him on the sidelines at Raiders games, just sort of watching him, just his persona, and kind of interesting.
With no jacket and a snowy game.
Well, they won snowy games in Oakland. But
well, but
you're on the road. Right. Yeah, I mean, at the stadium itself, just watching him live and... Daniel?
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't have any questions for you at this time, but this was quite thought-provoking, at least as to the fourth sentence.
So go ahead and be provoked.
Well, I don't know. It's one of those things where I'm going to go home today, and I'm going to pull out case 45, and I'm going to read it, and maybe you can come back someday.
Right. In the Book of Serenity, when you read the case... What's really the most difficult part, but also to me the most interesting part, is Wan Song, who's a commentator, who took Hanji's collection and made it into the Book of Serenity. And Wan Song is just, I just love this guy. He's really brilliant. He's got a sense of humor. He knows just where to kind of make an emphasis and where to step back. So when you read it, challenge yourself to read Wan Song's comments on it. Yeah.
I have a slightly different take on the last. Actually, it's pretty much the same, but there's a different way of reading it that I also heard. When it says something to the effect of I don't remember the exact quote, but you should not distinguish the truth, right? Something like that?
Yeah. Well,
The word should, in one way, of course, it means this is something that you should work toward, or you should work to not say, hey, I got it.
Yeah.
There's another way that should can be used, as in, you know, so I'm looking for the hammer. Where is it? Oh, it should be in the toolbox. So you're not so much saying, make the hammer be in the toolbox, as here's where you could maybe, I don't want to use a word like expect, because that's such a strong word in Zen, but that if you are in non-discriminating mind, truth or not truth does not arise. So you found the hammer in the toolbox, but you haven't found anything. So as I try to explain where I think the subtle difference is, it's harder to explain. But it just really is. And so the only way you would possibly recognize that you have non-discrimination mind is maybe later when you come back to discriminating mind, you go, oh, but probably in it, if you recognize it, that's not it.
But the question is whether you know the hammer's in the toolbox or not. That's the difference between the two things that you're talking about.
Whether you know the hammer's in the toolbox or not.
Yeah. And then you can say it should be in the toolbox.
Yeah.
But if we don't know the hammer's in the toolbox, then it's a different kind of should.
True. So if the hammer's in the... So if it's from the perspective...
It's your analogy.
Yeah. Well, so my... So, yes.
Wait a second. Why do you read that sentence again?
Okay. Yeah. Well, now, also, this is Cleary's translation. Okay. And everybody's going to have... They can take these words. Master Shen Yun's translation... Actually, this is pretty much Master Shen Yun's translation, I think Cleary used. Amidst non-discrimination, you should not distinguish true reality.
You should not distinguish. So, yeah. In my analogy, I was meaning that the person saying the hammer should be in the toolbox knows it's in the toolbox. And so, as a practitioner who is, you know, not myself, but an advanced teacher who says you should not distinguish true reality, I'm saying that that if you didn't distinguish true reality later, maybe that was this non-discriminating mind.
Yeah.
But if you're meditating going, I've got true reality, then no.
But I say even later is a problem. Well, you say
later you are discriminating.
Yeah.
So, But yes, how would you then, what are you discriminating about?
Mary?
Well, I'm just, you know, as soon as you know, as soon as you cognize that you're in non-duality, you're not in non-duality anymore. You can have the experience, but you can't know that you had it in the usual sense of knowing, because that is thinking. That is a discrimination. Even if it's a picture or something, it's a separation. Mm. And I think it's just, maybe it's emphasizing, you know, it's like he's not to belabor the hammer, but he's pounding it home.
Yeah, he's...
Don't grasp after
it. Yeah, they say amidst... So in the middle of doing that is what they're poorly pointing at, in the middle of doing that. Yeah.
Well, I mean, how could you distinguish true reality anyways? I mean, that's where I'm having... Well, you think about it. Why isn't my delusive thinking part of true reality? Because it is.
Yeah.
You know, when I get on the train and I start to build up these delusive thoughts, then I see where I am in the second and third sentence.
Mm-hmm.
But... Yeah, that's the fourth one is one for me to ponder.
Maybe we should continue this over.
Okay.
Tea, what do you
think? That's fine.
We can certainly continue. Thank you.
Okay.